The world-famous Conservation Canine Camp will next be running in southeast Queensland, Australia, from the 21st to the 25th of August. Join us with your dog to start your journey into conservation detection. Visit padfoot.com.au to book your place today. Welcome to the Conservation Canine Podcast, the show that celebrates the dog teams protecting the natural world. I'm James Davis, and in this episode I'm joined by Paul Bunker from Chiron Canine. Paul is a conservation detection dog training specialist and researcher. Join us while we talk about Paul's life working with dogs, talk about some of the amazing projects he's been involved in, and what he's working on at the moment. Welcome to the Conservation Canine Podcast. So we've tried to do this once before and technology failed us. So thanks very much for taking the time to jump on another call with me. And I really appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks, James. And I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you and all your guests.
No, anytime, mate, anytime. So let's start with, as we usually start, for those people who may not be aware of you or fully across, what you do and so on, how about a little bit of backstory? How'd you get started in this line of work?
Yeah, so I was actually raised, well, my father had a farm and I'd go and stay with him at weekends and summer holidays and things. And, it was out in the country in England and there was no other children in the area or anything. So I spent a lot of my time with the dogs. And he had hunting dogs, pointers, Labradors, border collie back then. And I'd just wander around the fields, and go looking in the hedges, finding birds' nests and different stuff, and just spend my time in the country. And, then he moved to a small village, living in a cottage and same sort of setup. During the week I was at my mum's in a city, and then at weekends I was in the country. So I had no friends out there, but I'd walk the dogs and spend time again out in the country. And then when I decided I wanted a career, I kind of realized that I wanted to move into dogs, but there's at the time very limited opportunities. I tried to join the police actually, and at the time there was a height restriction. I think it was like 5'10" or something, because I'm only 5'8", or I was back then 5'8". I'm even shorter now, but they said it was too small to join the police. And I was kind of thinking I'd go in the police and then be a police dog handler. And the only other opportunity was the armed forces. So I joined the army as a dog trainer in the Royal Army Veterinary Corps, and then ended up serving 22 years, which, the military life, it has its ups and downs. But overall, on the dog side, I wouldn't swap it for anything. I got to travel the world and train all sorts of different dogs. I did several special projects, which I absolutely loved. And then when I retired from the military, actually, my last 2 years was training American forces, United States Army engineers in landmine detection. And when I retired after 22 years, they invited me over for 1 year to set up an off-leash detection dog program, which I did in Missouri. And on completion of that, I went back to the UK, and a couple of weeks later got a phone call. We're transferring the project, the off-leash detection dog project, down to Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio, Texas, which is the school of military working dog training in the United States. Would you come over and help it bed into the schoolhouse? Thought, yeah, that's a great opportunity. And originally it was for 6 weeks. And then it kind of ended up 12 weeks, 36 weeks. And then they wanted some more Brits to go over and help with the different programs just because it was expanding so quick. And ended up doing 6 years, I think it was, at the schoolhouse there. And then I moved up to North Carolina for a year and established a combat tracking school, canine school, for the Army. That was for 1 year. And on completion of that, I was asked to join a commercial organization that trained dogs up there. supporting the United States Marine Corps. So I did that. I was in charge of handler course for, I don't know, about a year. Then I went into project management of research and development, and it was all detection dog based. There was no invasive research or anything, but it was interesting work, working with the universities, nutrition, cognition. Dr. Brian Hare, you've probably heard of The Genius of Dogs. That was part of it. And actually, there's a very scant or brief mention of the dogs that I was in charge of that was on in that research, which was the service dogs in the cognition trials. We did nutrition, hydration, heat tolerance, homemade explosives. It was quite a cadre of actual research that we were doing under this one large project. So I was the project manager and then the program manager for research and development. And then actually I took a year off and I hiked the Appalachian Trail, which is at the time 2,183 miles long. So my son and I hiked that for just under 6 months. And then I went back to the company and actually was promoted to director of the canine school. I did that for a year. And while I was doing that, I kind of started the oil spill detection response dog teams. And we went up to Canada for 4 months. There was myself with a canine and then three other members of the team supporting a response on a huge oil spill up there. And I spent 4 months on the ground, 5 days a week, actually working in the field with my dog. We were doing, you know, miles and miles a day. There was moose and bear and beaver, and we had to travel everywhere on boats. It was very remote once we were out there. And, you know, I came back and I realized that's what I miss. I actually loved being out in the wilds. I loved working a dog, not sitting at a desk managing resources and people. And 4 weeks later, I resigned from that company and started my own business, which is Chiron Canine. And that was 3.5 years ago. So my focus on leaving was always that I had this love of research and I had this love of conservation and environmental work. So I combined the both of them, and that's the focus of my company now. It's predominantly detection, focusing on conservation, environmental work, and then about, at the minute, 50%, if not more, of my work is actually research, supporting academic research and detection of dog canine detection, you know, in different tasks and different roles. So that's kind of it in a nutshell.
No, that's great. And it gives a really, really, really good background there. So perhaps if we start first on the research side of things, what research have you been involved in? Are you currently involved in? You know, where is that all at?
Yeah, within my own company, you know, in the last 3.5 years. So we've done several research projects. Some of them have been on oil detection, oil spill and pipeline detection with canines. In February 2020, which was right before, obviously, COVID and all the restrictions. I mean, literally a week before all the restrictions came down, we had a research trial here at the location I'm based in, Somerset, which is south of San Antonio in Texas, where we were establishing the ability of dogs to detect heavily weathered oils. And the idea is that, you know, when there has been an oil spill, you take a dog out onto a beach or something. Well, after a period of time with the interaction with weather, degradation and bacterial activity, aging, and then the wave motions, everything else, it ages the oil, and some of it is years and years old. So we had samples actually which were many years old, very heavily weathered, and we were looking at, can dogs actually locate this really old oil? And that was within a laboratory setting. It was on the scent carousel that I have there, in the research facility that I actually established. So we did that with three dogs, and that was a great success. And then phase two of that, we actually took the same samples and buried them 5 meters below the ground. So there was 6 samples buried and then 4 controls, and they were all done in 5 meter, 15 foot P PVC piping, which had an outer core of PVC, and they were placed in the ground. And then we worked the dogs through the area. It was a couple of acres inside in size. It was double blind to myself and the other handler with three dogs, to see if the dogs could even find that really heavily aged oil at such a deep depth. And, you know, 15 feet, 5 meters is about the deepest pipelines would be buried. So the idea was to replicate some sort of leak on a pipeline, but also capability of dogs. And actually the dogs did really well. It was like a 99% detection of all those products. And we had a PID, which is, now I can't remember the technical name, but basically it has the ability to analyze the VOCs coming off the source of an odor and say, yes, it's present or not. So we were using a PID device on the locations the dogs responded on. And on some of the locations, you know, the PID did detect like an inch from the soil surface or even less, 6 parts per million or below. And in fact, on one of the targets, which was really heavily aged, it couldn't detect anything, but all the dogs detected it. So it just demonstrated, you know, capability of dogs. They were airing up and changing direction on some of those finds at 30, 60 feet plus from source, and then going all the way to the source and identifying where it was. So that was kind of the first two phases of that research. And then the third phase was with Dr. Nathan Hall at Texas Tech University, which I'm sure a lot of people are aware of. And I had this theory because when I was working at a government school, government canine training school, one of the schools actually would not allow you to cut your training explosives down to smaller sizes. You know, it had to be used in the size of block that it came from the manufacturers. So C4 was in a block of 1.25 pound and never less. That's all it ever was. Same with the TNT, etc. So, you know, we train the dogs day in, day out on these quantities. And then we'd go out to the training facility in Arizona in the desert for environmental training, where we could actually use different amounts of explosive. And what I saw was, you know, even these, though the dogs were well exposed and well experienced in certain training aids, that they would actually struggle on the smaller training aids. And I had this hypothesis in my mind that, you know, if you only train on 1.25 pounds, your dog will only find 1.25 pounds or thereabouts. So I was discussing this with Nathan Hall, and it happened also to be a complaint, if you like, of the oil response people that the dogs are finding too much and too little. You know, they were finding the size of your thumbnail of oil on reeds on a riverbed. And really, you don't need to clean, well, not really, you don't need to clean that up, because bacteria and weather will just get rid of that over the course of a few days with no issue. But the dogs were finding everything. And I spoke about the 4 months up in Canada. We actually had something like 8,500 confirmed finds on that response. So you can imagine the amount of oil we were finding from that spill. And it was a kind of a complaint that, you know, we don't have to find all this oil. All we need to find is actionable oil. That's oil of a quantity that would cause an issue to the environment or wildlife. So I'd always said, well, I think you can calibrate a dog to locate certain quantities and ignore other quantities based on what I'd seen with explosives. But I had no proof. You know, I'd say that to people, and, well, where's the science? Well, I haven't got any. You know, I just think it can happen. So phase three of that research project was to demonstrate, could we calibrate a dog and teach it to ignore small amounts of a target odor, but actually respond on the target amount of a target odor? And then I went to Nathan Hall with that, and we discussed it, and he said he was interested in running the research, which was the first time we'd actually had an opportunity to work together. So I was keen. And also I was keen that that question that kept being asked to me from the oil response community had the robustness of obviously Dr. Hall and his team backing it up rather than me just saying, well, I did some trials and yes, we can do it. So I was really happy that he agreed. And it was actually Dr. Mallory Duchant. She's now doctor. So Dr. Mallory Duchant, she actually did all the work on that project with the dogs. And at the end of that, which is the published work that's out at the minute, it does demonstrate, even though it was an initial pilot research, it does demonstrate that you can calibrate dogs to certain levels and teach them to ignore smaller amounts of a target. And that really answered a big question for the oil spill response community, because it meant, you know, in that case, they could receive a dog that actually only responds on quantities which are actionable. So that was some of the first research that we started doing. Yeah, we're currently just wrapping up actually a very large project, again with Dr. Nathan Hall and Maddie Joy. And that was 8 dogs. And it'll be like 8 months we've been going on that. We're just wrapping up, so I can't talk too much about it. That was a government-backed research project, and hopefully it will be published again in the very near future. But that was really interesting. And again, that research was based on observations that I'd seen in the field and felt that there was a potential limitation in what we as humans were doing with our dogs and not taking certain things into account. Again, I took it to Dr. Hall and his team. He was really interested. And we pitched an idea, and it was funded by the government because they felt that, you know, it really had some merit. So hopefully soon I can talk more about that. At the minute, you know, it's wrapping up.
Yeah. So a couple of questions on that before we kind of move on. So in terms of the oil that was buried 2 stories deep, or however much it was, 5 meters deep, how much oil did you put down there? So my question is, kind of how much oil did it take for a dog to indicate, you know, and obviously aged oil, as you said, on the surface? And what are the properties of oil? One of the things that came up when I was talking to Dr. Hall in our previous episode was that, you know, dogs obviously, you know, there's certain smells that they smell better or find easier to smell than other smells. And so I was wondering whether oil was one that they were particularly well, you know, tuned into or something like that.
Yeah, first of all, on the oil detection, you know, when I went up to Canada with the first oil dogs, and that was, I don't know, 3-5 years ago or so, you know, the first ever dog we trained on oil detection, went up there with the team to a real oil spill response. And we'd been out, we'd gone to Nova Scotia with the same dog, and he'd done really well up there, but it wasn't a massive spill response. That was more a bit more field research. So when we went out there, you know, I just didn't know. You know, when you first start training any type of brand new dog to detect something, you just don't know. You're hoping your heart, I've got it right. I've done the right training program. I've got the dog prepared for real life. You know, when you get up there, as soon as you let that dog go, you just, please find something, or, you know. But literally on the first day, literally within a few minutes, the dog's head's up and it's bolting down the riverbank. And this is out in the wilds on this riverbank. And I didn't have a clue, you know, where's he going? And he was really head up going as if he got an odor, but it wasn't like 3 meters away, you know. And it was about 20 meters away. And he gave a nice response, and we followed up, and there was this clump of old matted oil that had mixed in with some vegetation and leaves and stuff. I mean, when I looked, I couldn't really see it. I had to pick up what he was responding on. And there was a piece of oil about the size of a cigarette packet, but it was a lump, you know, it all combined with leaves and vegetation. And I realized, you know, we've got it right. Obviously, that first find is the one that where your heart just jumps and you're so happy and everything, you know, we've got it right. We've done the right thing. But it didn't stop. You know, the dog was finding all sorts. And it was literally, like I said, it was a fingernail, a little fingernail-sized piece on a piece of vegetation. The dog jumped off the boat, aired up, went about, I don't know, maybe 8 meters or so, and sat on this reed bed. And I walked up and looked and looked and looked, and then I could just see this staining on the reeds that it was responding on. And we found oil mixed in sediment 2 feet under the flowing river. We found huge mats. You know, we found it in log piles. It was just all over the place. And the dogs were just finding it constantly. And I think it's one of those target odors that they are just so tuned to that they find it so easy to find. So during that Canada trip, you know, I realized there's no issue in dogs finding oil. They can find it. You know, even we went back over the course of 3 years, and the winters up there, the river froze 6 meters deep. And then it thawed out, and we could only work in the summer before the winter freeze and after it thawed. So that oil is really heavily weathered and been through severe weather, and the dogs were still finding it without an issue, even buried. And I realized, you know, that the dogs aren't having an issue. Well, moving on from there into the research trials and in my research lab, I ended up actually, I put literally a eyedropper drop of oil in sand in a mason jar, mix it all up, store it in a freezer, and then put it out and work my dogs on it. And they still get it, but it's so volatile that I can't use much more oil than that because it just fills my room, you know, to a dog.
Yeah.
It's just too much. Mm. So one of the limits, and kerosene I can't use at all. It's just too volatile.
Too
the
much.
Dogs are finding it too easy. And what I end up doing is losing any search technique because there's no search. The dog head is up and it's gone and it's found it. Yeah. And that kind of has been a bit of a limitation in that you have to be really clever about the amount of odor or how you put the odor out just to calm the dogs back a bit so you can work them before they find the target. Otherwise, you spend a lot of time just finding targets, but not actually doing your systems of search and everything you really need to practice. So, the oil, it's just a really nice substance to deal with because it is so easy, even when it's severely weathered. So the amount we put down at 5 meters, it came in six types. And some of them were severely weathered from the seabed. And they were like axle grease. They were very thick, even though they'd started as an oil. They were very thick. You couldn't pour them. You know, they just stuck there. And then some ranged all the way up to very fluid type oils. So we put about half a liter at 5 meters deep, which, you know, I thought wasn't a lot, but actually the dogs were finding it again too easy. You know, we could have easily gone a quarter or half of that and still had the same results. And it's still out there actually. So it sat there now since February 2020. Mm-hmm. And next week we're gonna actually work the dogs on it and see what they do. So it's been weathering even more. It's just sat there in the Texas sun, et cetera. Still at 5 meters. You know, we haven't lifted it or anything, but we just left it in place. And a professor's coming down. I'm going to work the dogs on it and see what results we get from that.
Mm.
So, yeah, I mean, the oil's been really interesting. It's not a lot. It is very volatile. It obviously can move through the subsurface structure itself. So it is very volatile in that nature that it gets everywhere.
Mm. Yeah, no, that's really interesting piece of work. You'll have to make sure we stay informed of what further findings you get in that space.
It's actually it's moving forward in that I'm now doing research with the United States Navy with oil, and we're looking further at what does the dog actually use within an oil to locate oil?
Yeah.
So they're sending me samples, which I'm totally blind to. The trials are double blind. I report the results, and I don't even know what's in those samples. The scientist, actually, it's Dr. Lauren de Greef, which I'm sure a lot of people have heard of as well, and Stephanie Vaughan, her PhD. Not a student, is it? It's after the PhD. I'm terrible with academics. I flunked school really bad. So but she's already a doctor. Stephanie Vaughan is actually running that project with Dr. LeGrief. So, DeGrief. So they send me these samples. I don't know what's on the tubes specifically. I work the dogs and tell them, yes, we find something or no, we don't. The idea, again, is that we can map the canine's nose ultimately and kind of hopefully they can work out, you know, well, these are the profiles a dog uses and these are the profiles it doesn't. And it'll give us a better understanding of what's going on in the dog's nose across the spectrum, you know, not just for oil, but if we can understand some more about what are dogs using and what aren't they using to find the substance. So in that case, you know, we presented the full oil, but then we're testing them on parts of the oil, not the full oil. So,
yeah.
Yeah, sense. Another interesting one.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And is there anything else you're working on outside of oil?
Yes, we're going to start Dr. Hall and Debbie Duchon of Muscle Dogs in California. Yeah, and Dr. Barnes from Texas Tech. He's an invasive muscle expert. So we have got a trial in September for a month. And what we're looking at is comparing the capability of dogs to locate muscle velinger, muscle eggs, in water samples in comparison to eDNA. There's invasive species over here in the US, zebra mussels, which are spreading throughout the country, and they've got into Texas now. And one of the ways of actually testing water sources for the presence of these mussels is using eDNA. Well, the proposal is, or the hypothesis is, that dogs could do it quicker, cheaper, but also the capability is that possibly Debbie's dogs, which actually search boats at the minute as they come out of water and check that there's no mussels on the boat and being transferred to other water sources, that those same dogs could potentially sample water, take water samples from different water courses or lakes or rivers or anything, present it to the dog, and it says, yeah, there's invasive mussels in that sample, or no, there's not. So, of course,
there's lots of benefits to that with the water, in that presumably the water can be collected and then taken to the dog in whatever location the dog is in and just tested within the lab context or something like that.
Yeah, so that's what we're going to do. Well, two phases. The primary phase here is that Dr. Barnes and his team are going to collect samples from known lakes with invasive mussels and then lakes that are known not to have it, present it to the dogs, and we determine the results and say, yes, that one has invasive mussels or doesn't. So that would be your lab-based.
Yep.
But equally, the intent is we are going to go actually to some lakes. They're going to take samples. And then on the lake side, we'll present it to the dogs and see if we get a field deployable resource as well. So that, again, when Debbie's out with her dogs, or they could send them to different projects, you have a multi-role of the dog searching the watercraft coming out and in checkpoints like they currently do. But also that same dog could do water sampling as well. So,
yeah. But surely it'd be more efficient to the former method. So rather than actually having to deploy a dog in the same, so I'm just thinking in terms of cost and practicality and so on, wouldn't the emphasis be on the, actually getting the water samples and taking them to the dog, wherever the dog may be?
Yeah. If it's a lake or an area that's not known to have the invasive mussels, or you want to monitor effective control techniques or everything, absolutely it would. But the major problem with these mussels is that they, in use of a boat on a lake, they get into the motor and into the boat itself and transported from lake to lake in that manner. That's how they've spread, because people aren't cleaning the boats when they get out the water, not draining, not cleaning properly. Mm-hmm. And the mussels are actually being spread from lake to lake. So that's why currently the dogs actually search boats coming out of lakes, because that's the most effective method, obviously quick and easy, go around a boat. And they are highly effective to actually identify any mussels that are being transported about and get them cleaned off before that boatman moves to a different lake.
Mm. Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, that's Yeah, it's always the problem with invasive issues like that, isn't it? It's just all that transportation, invasive weed, invasive, you know, fauna. It just gets around, and you know, how can you, if people aren't going to clean properly, you've got to find some way of compelling them to.
Yeah, I mean, the checkpoints obviously can do so much. Here in Texas, we don't have the checkpoints. It's on boater education, but also they just announced another lake has been invaded by zebra mussels. So my assumption is, you know, the education works for the majority, but not all. So they're still spreading throughout the state, unfortunately.
Yeah, no, that's a shame. Well, hopefully that works out well.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting project. We're all excited about it. And, you know, it's brand new. And it's a good collaboration with myself, Debbie from California. She's bringing six dogs, Dr. Hall, and then Dr. Barnes, who's obviously an invasive mussel specialist. So an interesting group.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so moving on from the research side of your work then to your book. So Imprint Your Detection Dog in 15 Days, of which I have a copy right here, right with me. So where did the book kind of come from? Why did you write the book? Who have you written the book for? What's the intent?
So I started a book about 20 years ago, maybe, no, 16 years ago or so. And I've actually got a chapter still written on my computer that's as far as it got. And, you know, I've always wanted to write a book, but never kind of had the direction or the focus that I needed to think, who needs this book? You know, who would read it? And do I really want to write a book? So it sat there on my computer and it still sits there as the original idea. And then February, March of this year, actually, a friend of mine, Sally Smith, who owns Canine Principles in the UK, which is an online canine academy, I tutor for her and I have done for about 3 years. Canine behavior, canine coaching. I do the search dog handler course for her. So she was running this write your own book in 30 days. She's a prolific writer and has got a lot of books published in dog fear, dog anxiety, those sort of things. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know what? It's the pandemic. I haven't got a lot on. 30 days is doable. So I said, okay, I'll do this course. And I started on day one, and on day 30, I had a book, or, you know, at least the major framework of the book that needed edited and stuff, but it was there. When I started the book, I had one idea of what I was going to do. But what happened was you had to brainstorm and do these different tasks within the 30-day program. And I realized, you know, I need to focus this book on one aspect of dog training, not try and train everything in one book. You know, it's not going to happen. It's going to be too much. And you can only do so much in a book before you lose people. And I thought, well, the first stage is imprinting. And when I do run projects like the horned lizard project we got down here, and we haven't spoke about it, but the Wyoming toad that I'm on at the minute as well, you know, that we do a lot with the volunteers. And the first stages are very basic of how do you train your dog to find a target odor and give a response. And I spend a lot of time at the first part of the project just teaching that phase, where I was thinking, you know, people could do this and come to me once they've got that part in place, and we can go into the more technical side of dog handling and the more complex aspects that we need to work on, instead of spending a lot of time on kind of the basics, if you like. So I thought, right, I'm going to focus this book on just how to imprint your dog. Nice and simple. I have a 15-day process. I've always had a 15-day process. And I kind of decided that's what I was going to do. I'll put it into place with a progression plan, with the steps for success and everything, but also add chapters about how to handle your storing aid and store your training aids, which is, you know, absolutely critical. If you don't get that part right, then you're going to fail in a lot of your projects. So I decided to do some chapters as well on the basics. And the idea was anyone can pick up this book, start on day one, and by day 15, they should have a dog that responds on a target. It's, you know, fairly simple, three choice setup, nothing too complex, but also an understanding of how to handle the training aids, where to get them from, how to look after them, how to put them out for the canine, motivation, reward selection, you know, everything that you should have in your toolbox to get you to imprint a dog. And again, initially, you know, the idea was that I was aiming at search and rescue, cadaver dog people, and conservation type people. These people that wanted to take it to a semi-professional or even professional level, but had nowhere to go. And that kind of came from ecologists would call me or contact me and say, I've got a dog at home. You know, I want to train it to help me at work. And imprinting was something that, again, that I'd spend a lot of time talking them through, but, you know, I couldn't really do it with them. They're up in Montana or, you know, wherever they are. And for one person with their pet dog, it's not worth me flying up there for 3-4 weeks to actually do all this work with them and then to ship the dog down. So I kind of aimed it towards these types of people because then I can do the follow-on training that's, as I said, more technical systems of search and how to use a GPS and first aid and report writing and the things really that make the service professional, I could actually take them through to field ready.
Yeah, that's what I was going to get at, really, because looking at the book, part of the challenge with these things is always how do you kind of meet the criteria? It's such a complicated thing, right? You know, so we know, you know, you and I know that every search, every target, everything's different. Every single dog, you know, so the way you engage a particular dog, the indication you'll get from different dogs on different target odors and, yeah, the search patterns and, you know, and all of that sort of stuff. And so before I picked up the book, I was thinking, oh, you know, how is Paul going to kind of cover all of that stuff? Because that's the sort of stuff that mean, you know, those are the reasons why you can't just go and do, you know, a 2-3-5-2-week course and then go out and work as a professional in this field. You know, you need to get that much deeper understanding of all of those other, yeah, aspects. So I think, you know, like focusing in on the imprinting, you know, and really doing that bit, you know, well, is a great way of avoiding that pitfall, I suppose. And it gives people a really, really great way of just wrapping their heads around the thing. I mean, in fact, you know, talking to Heath Smith at Rogue, I think it is, they use it, you know, for people coming into their program. It's a bit of sort of mandatory, you know, pre-join reading, which, you know, is a glowing testimonial, really. One question I had, and it's something I was chatting to our mutual friend Louise Wilson from Conservation Canine Consultancy about. So in the book, you talk about using Kong, which is obviously very popular, particularly, you know, in tracking, particularly in kind of narcotics or explosive search, yeah, those kind of things. The issue with Kong from a conservation perspective is that, you know, it doesn't really get the same emotional response, you know, from the dog as a natural scent, as you might find in the conservation context. You know, it's that artificial kind of plasticky scent. And so I was wondering kind of what your thoughts were on that and, you know, why, you know, you selected Kong, you know, as the general training aid, you know,
So, you know, a couple of things is that in the explosives world, you know, I found very much pushback on using Kong. And I never used Kong in general search because of that, you know, because people don't want to take a drugs dog out and it responds on a Kong in a drawer. And I can understand that, you know. But in the conservation world, landmine detection, oil detection, all these sort of things, it does have an application that you have a neutral odor capability. So with oil, you cannot use oil by pouring it on the ground or anything, obviously, because, you know, then I'm causing the exact contamination that we're trying to prevent. And we can't put it in rivers. We can't put it in lakes. We can't leave it out for several days.
The dog will be indicating on every car that goes past.
Right. And unless it's in research where we've actually, you know, we've done all the risk mitigation and we've done everything else that we needed to bury it for 5 meters. But, you know, in general training, I can't do that. And in conservation, like the Wyoming toad, you know, they are critically endangered that I can't have a permit to even touch them. You know, there there's no way I
always
can.
Always a challenge, yeah.
And it's in Wyoming, and I live 1,000 miles away. So how do I train a dog for everything I need it to do and then get it up there and field imprint, which is what I did 2 weeks ago? Now, I did select Kong for a number of reasons. And again, I go into this in the book, but what I like about Kong is I can take it anywhere. You know, I can put it in on the plane with me. I can leave it in Lowe's. Lowe's is a do-it-yourself superstore that we have here that allow dog training, actually actively allow people to train their dogs in their buildings. And if it gets lost, you know, if it gets moved in a can of paint or something, whatever, you know, with a can of paint, so be it. I've lost a bit of rubber. But I could also bury it. I can leave it out in all weathers and my dog still be have the ability to find it and actually have the experience of naturalized odor where there's no fresh human scent, where vegetation has grown over it and naturalized it, etc. So I think it has a lot of advantages. But like I say in the book, any neutral odor is absolutely perfectly acceptable. You know, if you wanted to use something else, there's no issue. What it allows for me is an opportunity to train all the systems, like the response, like the search systems, etc., on a neutral odor. But then, like for Wyoming, I then travel up to Wyoming, field imprint my dog onto the toad, and my dog already understands how to search.
Yeah.
How to respond, how to use odor, etc.
Understands the job. Yeah.
On a neutral odor. And actually, I got up there, and the first ever search I did with her, I put some Kong out. I settled her into the environment. I let her find some Kong. So she knew, okay, we do this up here now. And it was on a lakeside in Reeds, etc. So already the area starts to become productive. Then we did some field imprinting, and then actually worked her onto the toads, and she had a find by day three. So it's something for me that's adaptable, it's usable, it's easy, it's cheap. Kong actually sent me pounds of the stuff, so I have no issues cutting it.
Sponsored by Kong. Yeah, yeah.
Yes. I mean, they have been so good to me as a company, you know, that's what, again, you know, they are in my book, but they've been great. And I think they're great for the dog community. In the UK, I believe, but also in the US, and I don't know what it's like in Australia, but, you know, they give us enrichment for our dogs in kennels and sponsor our work. And, you know, they do so much as a company to promote dogs that I have no issue using their products. And they, you know, they fit in with what I do. So was there a specific reason? No. I wanted a neutral odor, and it...
easily accessible.
All the boxes.
Yeah.
Cheap, easy, repeatable. I can leave it anywhere. It's durable. You know, you can leave Kong out for months and the dogs will still find it.
Yeah.
So that's the pure reason. And it has advantages, like with the Wyoming Toad Project specifically. You know, I wouldn't have been able to achieve that success without a neutral odor, whatever neutral odor that was. But I just find that Kong fits what I do. But I, you know, I do stress in the book, again, choose any neutral odor. Choose any response, whether it's sit, down, stand, whatever you want. You know, I try and made it as open as possible to say, your dog must sit and you must use Kong. I never want to do that, but I at least give you the steps and say, you know, if you follow this process and you make it fit with what you want, you know, your odor, your response, etc. Even the containers, you know, if you don't want to use stainless steel spice shakers, don't. Use whatever you want. But, you know, the process works and it's flexible enough to make it fit your program.
Yeah, and I think that's the great thing about the book, and that's probably the reason why the Rogue team are using it and why it's been so well received, you know, in the industry is that there's a lot of complexity there. And as we are, one of the central tenets of the book is to train the dog in front of you. But how do you explain what that means to somebody? So say you've got somebody with zero experience in detection and they've bought your book because they're interested in detection. you know, there's an element of having to give them a bit of a step-by-step guide to, you know, you must do this, you must do that, because otherwise they get confused. But you also need to cover off that, oh, yeah, and by the way, train the dog in front of you type question. So, you know, I think it covers that off really well. Was that something you worked really, really hard to kind of try and craft into the book, or was that just the experience coming through?
I think a mixture of both. I think in the, you know, like the reward selection exercise that's right at the start.
Yeah.
And I think that's an important lesson that I wanted people to understand. You know, just picking a tennis ball off the shelf of your local pet store and giving it to your dog doesn't mean your dog actually enjoys a tennis ball. No. You know, and we see that a lot. And, you know, I see it in a lot of organizations where everyone uses a red Kong. And you know, I'm going on about how I love Kongs, but everyone uses a red Kong. And when you ask, why do you use a red Kong with your dog? Well, that's what everyone else uses. You know, the first question is, what does your dog enjoy? And that's one of the first things in the book. You know, actually go through a reward selection process where the dog tells you, this is what I enjoy doing, whether it's retrieving, tugging, or treats. And then, do I like retrieving a tennis ball, a red Kong, a plastic ball, whatever it is? Let the dog decide what it wants to work for. And that kind of first step is something that I do with all my dogs, regardless, because I do think it's important. But I was hoping it opens people's eyes. You know, the first thing you do is do this test and then realize, oh, wait a minute. You know, my dog actually picked that ball three times. So that it really likes that ball. And that there's choices in the dog's mind that are going to carry you forward. You know, it's not just a case of, well, they say use a tennis ball, so I'm going to use a tennis ball. So, yeah, it was kind of crafted in that way. And it's something I always do. I always clicker train all my dogs, regardless if I'm ever going to use a clicker later in their program. I think the clicker has a lot of advantages in what it teaches a dog to do with its brain before you even start training. So, again, you'll see in the book, I clicker train. I say in it, you know, you don't have to use a clicker. You can use any marker. If you're not a clicker person, then say yes. It's perfectly fine. It's just that I always use a clicker. But some years ago, 25, 30 years ago, a friend of mine, Alec Cool, he actually had a VHS videotape, which I suppose for the younger people that are listening, it was like a plastic cassette. You played film on the TV, and it was of clicker training from the USA, which, you know, it hadn't really made it to the UK at the time. And I looked at it and I saw this guy clicking and giving treats and stuff. And I was thinking, what a circus trick. And I think I said that to him, you know, what a circus trick. That ain't dog training. You know, that's not what we do. And actually forgot about it for a couple of years until I had a problem on the Mind Dog program, which was solved with clicker training. And when I actually applied clicker training, I realized how good it is, because I think not only do you obviously clicker train the dog, but you get their brain in line with learning. They start to enjoy the whole process of offering behaviors. They start to understand luring technique as a training technique. They start to understand capturing and shaping. And it's kind of like this light bulb goes off, and I see the dogs get absolutely excited to want to train during clicker training process, because I think it just switches their mind on to that whole focus of, well, I have choices and I can do things, and this is fun and rewarding. And, you know, all the nice things that potentially some dog trainers are cringing about, but the dogs are starting to get into their mind focus of training. So I do it with all my dogs, regardless, because of that. I think it sets them up.
I think that's right. And it's also quite good, I find, at kind of countering human error. And so often you find with the yes marker, for example, you know, people will forget to use it, you know, when they're caught up in the heat of the moment, or they'll say it more quietly than normal, or more loudly than normal, or with the wrong emphasis than normal, or anything like that. You know, whereas with a clicker, it's consistent. It's consistent. It sounds the same every time. It means what it means. People generally don't forget to apply it because it gives them something they actually have to do. You know, it's got a lot of benefits, I think. How did that help you with that mine project, just to sort of jump back 30 years?
Yeah, so on the video, they were showing this guy training his dog to do agility, and he clicker trained it, and then he trained it to put its nose on the end of a touch stick, which was a long stick, if I remember, with a red, like ping pong ball on the end type thing. And then he would lure the dog with that actual touch stick over a jump, and the dog would follow it and touch its nose and get a click treat, which is wise. And catwalk was the same. You know, the dog would go up the catwalk following its nose along the touch stick that the guy was holding. And that's why I kind of said, that's a circus trick. Well, one of the things we had to do with the mine dogs, and the whole premise of these dogs was they were to rescue people trapped in minefields. We'd had some incidents with British forces where, unfortunately, we'd lost some individuals that have been trapped in a minefield, injured, and you can't just rush in there, obviously, the doctors, to get to them. And they wanted a way to clear a path for the medics to recover the person or treat them on site or whatever. If there'd been a vehicle crash or an aircraft crash, or they just wandered into a minefield inadvertently, or even wandered in and got injured somehow. So the idea was the dogs were to search, clear, and this is the only time we use the term clear a path 1 meter wide, 50 meters long, so the medics could actually extract the person that was trapped. Well, the guys are wearing this massive bomb suit. The dogs have been found to find landmines, but the problem was the system of search to ensure they cover every inch of ground with their nose in a systematic fashion, but under control. And I had the guys, you know, and I was in charge of the whole project. So it was, you know, there was zero template. It was just me making this up as we went along. Had the guys lying down in this big bomb suit, kind of sweeping their hand across the ground for the dog's nose to follow. And that didn't work. And on their knees and then bent over. It just didn't work. You know, the protective equipment they was in, et cetera. And then I suddenly thought, wait a minute. I saw this circus trick where this dog held its nose on the end of a touch stick. And we had these mine probes, which are about a meter long, that you use to probe the ground to see if there's a landmine there. I put a wine cork on the end of one of them. And then I taught a dog to actually put its nose as a touch stick on the wine cork and then follow the wine cork. And all we did was then move in a zigzag pattern, 1 meter wide, 50 meters long, telling the dog to touch. It would touch its nose on the end of the probe with the wine cork along the ground and sweep its nose along the ground in a figure of eight fashion. And then if it came to the odor of the target, it gave a sit response because it knew that was jackpot. It would get its jackpot toy. So that kind of overshadowed the touching of the wine cork, which was for treats, that all of a sudden I smell my jackpot toy. I'm going to sit and I'm going to get my tennis ball. So, you know, the clicker training actually resolved that whole issue and made the program successful because it meant at a walking pace, nicely controlled, nice and steady, the handlers could stand up and the dogs would just search every inch of that ground methodically before moving forward. And we'd already achieved 100% detection rate with the dogs of the target. That wasn't the issue. It was applying the capability to the ground that then became the issue, which was solved simply by clicker training and the touch stick.
Yeah, that's it's fascinating and ingenious at the same time. And, you know, yeah, it's just quite, yeah, it staggers me really in terms of, you know, how you came up with that and how you, you know, really, I mean, did you have any problems kind of getting that through the hierarchy, you know, when you're trying to do an experimental sort of technique or anything like that, you know, does that run, you know, in the military, do you run into any issues there?
I was a really good time for this to happen because the OC in charge, Major Matt Sheriff, he had a lot of confidence in me. and some of the things, because I'd introduced, or partly I'd introduced the passive response, because prior to that, you know, back in the days, we used to put explosives in plastic PVC tubes with holes in and throw them down the street, live explosives, you know, nitroglycerin and stuff. And the dog would retrieve it and then we would hide it and they would scratch, dig and bark to get to it. And that's what we did, you know, in the olden days. And when we realized we needed to train a passive response, I was fortunate. I went on a month-long instructor's course with the civilian police in the UK, and they'd started teaching the passive response. I saw it there. Actually, I came back to the school, and there was a bit of pushback at the time, and it was the Australian Army had sent a couple of diggers over for some training. A guy called Wrecker, Sean Quinn, and Mark Lewinsky, and the Australians had actually said, you know, we want you to train our guys on this 3-month instructor's course in detection, but they must be taught passive response to the dogs. So it was actually, that was the first course with their instructor, Dave Rowlandson. They actually taught that program and did the passive response with their dogs. And I think at the time, you know, the OC came out to watch the dogs working and that, thought, this is great. You know, why are we throwing explosives down the road when dogs can do this? And around the same time, the landmine program started, you know, which obviously has to be passive. Well, it doesn't, but you'll only find a landmine once if you're not got a passive dog, you know. So it kind of happened that, you know, all at once, the jigsaw fit together. Everything came at the right time. It was the right person in charge, the OC. He basically gave me an open hand and said, off you go. We worked on a base, which was like 10 miles from the main school. So we travel there every day with our dogs and we're left to it. And basically told, come up with a solution to all the problems you have and, you know, come back when you're ready. It was actually the Royal Engineers sponsoring all the work. So that was good because, you know, they were the ones that wanted this work to be done. So everything fell in place at the right time. And I'm glad to say, you know, the actual acceptance has gone on. And now, you know, I visit the school every so often, pre-COVID, obviously, traveling back there. You know, and they click a train and they use toy rewards, which we were never allowed to do. They use food. It's very positive-based training. You know, it's very much modern day training, if you like, that's been brought into the school, which is always good to see. But the quality of dogs is really good. When I think back, you know, 40 years when I started at the school, how we used to train and how we do now, I would not be as successful today on my projects if training hadn't evolved where we are today. If I'd still did the old, you know, check the dog, pat the dog, praise the dog type dog training we used to do, I couldn't achieve what I achieved today without a shadow of a doubt.
So let's talk about dogs now. What sort of dogs, what are the key characteristics, do you think, for a successful conservation dog? And do you have any breed preferences?
Personal breed preferences are Border Collie, although I don't own one. I have a Springer Spaniel and a Labrador myself. But actually, on the projects, we've got a big mixture of dogs. Dutch Shepherd, Malinois, Gila, mixed breeds. You know, there's a lot of different dogs on the projects, on conservation projects that volunteers bring that we were using. I kind of stick to the same principles. I ask everyone to click a train their dog. And, you know, I think, and as you said about Heath and road dogs using the book, I think that's a good selection process. I think if you can take your dog through the 15-day program and show me at the end that you've achieved the results, then I think that demonstrates several things. One is the capability of the person and the desire for them to be part of it, but also the dog. You know, the dog is open to learn, understands the concepts, has the ability to move forward into more complex issues and stuff. As for characteristics, obviously there's got to be some sort of drive for a reward. And I don't care if that's retrieve rewards or treat rewards or both. You know, my dogs are both reward-based, but we do have dogs that are just treat-driven. And that's perfectly fine. And, you know, I'm kind of on the fence right now thinking, would it be better to have conservation dogs in a program where you're looking for some sort of reptile or something where there is no retrieve drive, where it's purely food driven to stop any impulse issues, you know, or does that come in training? So, you know, I'm wondering, and I don't know that anyone's looked at this, is it easier to train a food driven dog only and not reward driven? But both my dogs are reward driven. So, you know, I'm not going to commit and say that's the end of it. I'm just wondering in my head, you know, are there advantages to that? But no, you know, they've got to have some sort of drive. They've got to be social. They've got to listen to the handler. I mean, I think it's generally the same for all types of detection dog. There is the impulse control, though, you know, and I do remember a story not so long ago, 3 years ago or so, where a program manager from Nova Scotia, he told me he had wanted dogs to support his program looking for some rare snake. He got a dog handler in and the dog had found the snake, but promptly killed it. And this was a super rare snake, you know, and he said, I'll never have dogs in my program ever again. That's it. You know, and you spoke about the importance of professionalism and it's not a 2 week course. And those are the sort of things that will happen if you don't understand the real depth of training that requires, particularly for certain species. You know, that's not what we need in the community, but it could happen if you just don't understand the ultimate concept. So that system of search and all the rest of it, where I said, you know, that's the important part. That's the part that needs professional help and really work on hard to ensure that you are effective in the field at finding something. But then once you find it, the response is correct and the reporting is correct and everything.
Yeah. So what's next, Paul? What are you up to?
Go back to Wyoming weekend after next for our field assessments with my dog to prove concept in a actual field survey environment. And there's three teams up there that we're imprinting while I'm up there. And then hopefully we can get them trained up for next year for the survey season. And then it's straight into the muscle detection dog project. And then straight after that, we're into a military army project, actually, in detection with Nathan Hall again for a while, potentially, and also another oil project. So, you know, the rest of the year and into next year are very busy at the minute.
Yeah, keeping you out of trouble, definitely.
Yeah.
Look, Paul, thanks so much for taking the time to chat again. Really appreciate it. So if people are interested in learning more about your work, keeping in touch with what you're doing, all that sort of stuff, how should they best do that?
Yeah, you know, I have Facebook, same as everyone, Chiron K9. It's Chiron K, the number 9. Instagram, which actually I post a lot more on Instagram now. Just quick photos and videos of what I'm up to.
You're a 25-year-old at heart.
And then the website, www.chiron-k9.com. And that's more, you know, the newsworthy events and research papers and stuff go into there.
Sure. Awesome. Well, thanks very much for taking the time again, mate. Really appreciate it. And best of luck with all the research and the new projects. And look forward to hearing about some great successes, you know, pretty soon from you.
Yeah. Thanks, James. Appreciate the time.
No worries, mate. Take care. Cheers.
Thank you for listening to the Conservation Canine Podcast. If you've enjoyed the show, please like, share, and subscribe wherever you find us.